From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Andrew James says he didn't know what kind of a risk he was taking when he went to Detroit to make a documentary film. He knew he didn't want to make an issue film, didn't think of himself as an activist, but he did know inequality and economic decay had devastated the black working class there, and he was hoping to find stories to show what that means. He found three, and his film is a deeply intimate portrait of their lives and their faith and how they're trying to build or rebuild something that lasts. Today in the program, Andrew James is joining us. He's a filmmaker who lives here. He spent something like 10 years on this project. We're going to be screening the film next Monday, talking about it today. It's called Street Fighting Men, after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Andrew James has made a really special film. A documentary that doesn't have experts trying to explain something to you. In fact, you don't really need anyone to explain this film to you. You just need to know it's Detroit, a city that's trying to make a comeback from decades of economic decline. And Andrew James follows three men. Jack Rabbit, a former cop. He's a fixture in the neighborhood, drives around trying to discourage drug deals and petty crime. And Luke, who works odd jobs and is trying to renovate an old crack house he bought for $1,500. And then there's Darris. He's the youngest of the three. He's trying to stay out of trouble, get an education, and take care of his baby daughter. The film is called Street Fighting Men, and today in the program we're talking about it with Andrew James. It's part of our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film next Monday. We'll give you details about that a little later on the program. James is a director, a cinematographer, and an editor who lives here in Salt Lake City. He also directed the film Clean Flicks about Mormon movie sanitizers. Before we get into the film, I wanted to go back a few years to some documentary films that you saw, okay, that you've talked about as being kind of influential in terms of what you wanted for this film. You saw Sweetgrass. That's one of them.
Yeah.
And this is a film, for people who don't know, it's about shepherds in the high country fields in Montana. And it was a remarkable documentary in that it was so spare. There were some shepherds singing, as I recall, maybe, but there was no music, no narration, no names given as titles, no exposition, no talking heads, and no sentimentality. Is that what you noticed in that film? Talk about that film. How did that strike you?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. The film is very sparse and observational and does lack sentimentality, and it's experiential because of it.
Yep.
It allows the audience to engage with the film on their own terms and come to the situation that's being presented to them with whatever baggage they have, whatever knowledge they have, and allows them to kind of formulate opinions and formulate feelings and engage emotionally with the material however makes most sense for them. And I think that way of filmmaking is a way for you as a artist or storyteller, as a filmmaker, as a journalist, to respect the audience, to not channel their energy into a certain way of thinking. And I really responded to that, and I was still new in my documentary education at that point. I was just getting in. I just made a documentary film for the first time and was really devouring all that I could. And it struck me, oh, you can make documentary films like this.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is what I want to do.
In the sense that you don't have to manipulate an audience. You can just lay it out there and let them come to their own.
Right.
Like opinions about it?
Right. And I think there's a big push for certain types of films to be activist films and for documentary filmmakers to be activists. And I don't really think of myself as an activist. I'm not out there like every day like working on causes or organizing things in the community, and I would think it'd be disingenuous to say I'm an activist. So I felt like it would be disingenuous to then approach a film from that point of view mm-hmm. and say, oh, I've got this perspective and I'm going to make sure I lay it all out in my film. I thought, no, I'm going to go to Detroit and I'm going to listen and I'm going to allow the natural ebb and flow of these men's lives to dictate what I do as a filmmaker.
You know, Sweetgrass was made by two anthropologists.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting. I wonder, as opposed to you mentioned activist, an anthropologist is different entirely. They're detached in some ways from the conclusion. They're just observing.
Right.
Do you see yourself like that on some level?
I do, yeah. I definitely, especially with this film, with this project, that was my approach from the beginning. I knew that as a, you know, a white person, an outsider to this community, I had to take a certain kind of approach, a certain kind of care with the material, really get to know the community, get to know the subjects. And you can really only do that if you spend time. And the more time you spend, I feel like it naturally pulls you away from this sort of sense of activism, because activism is all about this sort of urgency to get the story out there. And I wanted to go and be there. I wanted to go and catch it all, catch everything unfold. So it wasn't – I didn't want to, you know, ask someone, hey, what was it like when X happened to you? I wanted to be there, see it, get their reaction, and show people something true. So something real. And of course, I have my own filters and my own baggage, and you know, objectivity might not even be a real thing. But I wanted to approach it with as much care as I could and with as little sort of preconceived ideas as possible, as few preconceived ideas as possible.
We had a conversation last week with the novelist Alexandra Fuller. She's written this film. She has a British family background. She grew up in Africa, white. And she did this novel about two men living on an Indian reservation. And so the question always comes up, what right do you as a white person have to try and even attempt to tell the story of another culture, another, you know, ethnicity? How much of that was problematic for you, at least as you thought this out, like I'm going to come into these black neighborhoods as a white man and try to tell this story? How did you work that out in your mind?
Yeah, that's, you know, a really good question. Well, when I first approached the film, I was thinking of it more as a film about Detroit. And the film evolved in its making.
Yeah.
It's not really a film about Detroit anymore.
No, yeah.
But when I first approached this subject, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to find some stories that are going to help illuminate the situation in Detroit and have the film kind of speak to this question of what's happening in Detroit. And on some level, I think that's still true. But so when I first went in, I wasn't thinking about this whole, I'm white, they're black, and where do I fit in to this equation as a journalist and as a filmmaker? I was mostly just thinking about, you know, wow, we have industry that has fled this country, in Detroit specifically, and the fallout of that can be seen everywhere you look in Detroit. And the failures of our government, the failures of our various industries and policymakers are evident in the day-to-day circumstances of the people who live in Detroit. And that's what I found interesting at first.
Yeah. And so it wasn't about race.
It really wasn't even ever a question. But I got there and discovered that people were so hungry to be heard and so hungry to talk and to have their stories told. And especially now in Detroit, it's really a tale of two cities. It's a very large geographical area, and you have a mayoral election happening right now, and you have a lot of tech industries and like coffee shops and things that are like happening midtown and downtown that aren't really affecting the broader community of Detroit. Everyone thinks it's recovering, but... And in some sense, I guess you could say that it is.
Well, I think it is on some level. Like Shinola is like – that's one of those great stories. You're wearing a Shinola watch. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So that's like, oh, it's – but that hasn't moved everywhere, I guess.
No, not at all. And in fact, you know, most people in Detroit live in the neighborhoods, and that's where the film takes place. That's where Street Fighting Men takes place. It's about three men of different generations in the neighborhoods of Detroit. And so you're really – in my opinion, this film is really showing you that side of Detroit life, which is something that hasn't really been explored in many other films. There's a lot. The narrative is Detroit's making a comeback. Look at these great business owners. Look at these startups. Look at the tech stuff that's happening. And not to disparage any of that stuff, but, you know, it has brought in, you know, white people back into Detroit. And now you're seeing this sort of like core influx of white people and entrepreneurs in Midtown and downtown, while the rest of the city is still dealing with the fallout of everything that's happened in the past 30 years.
There's a professor that you've referred to from Wayne State University who talks about the three stories that are often told of Detroit. And I wanted to go through these and just have you talk about this impression that we have of that part of the country. Detroit, the first story that we hear is Detroit as ruin porn, which you see that a lot, these disheveled houses in these neighborhoods that you could buy for, you know, a couple grand or whatever. So as Detroit as ruin porn, Detroit as utopian possibility is another one the professor mentions. Mm-hmm. You see that too, those stories. And then Detroit as a metonym, you know, an expression of the American condition, kind of a bigger metaphor for what's going on.
Right.
Do those ideas – your film isn't really – which of those ideas do you think – the ruin porn has got to bother you because clearly you've seen that. What do you make of that, I guess, that impression?
I think that's a pretty good analysis.
Yeah.
And it's one reason why I avoided in my shooting shots of destruction and decay.
Yeah.
I mean, I did shoot it. I have all kinds of B-roll of Detroit that I didn't use. I ended up trying to cut the film from all A-roll, so to speak, where there's all action always happening on screen. The film rarely, if ever, cuts away to just a beauty shot. And earlier cuts of the film, it did, and I eventually worked most of that out of the film and made it much more narratively focused and much more character focused about the three men and their lives and their condition. The human condition is really the focus of the movie. And so I thought, you know, what am I going to get from showing these kinds of images? And it's also because it's a thing now. You know, people look and say, oh, it's just ruin porn. And audiences are becoming more educated, and you have to make sure and respect that. So I avoided those shots. In terms of the sort of utopian possibility, I mean, that's kind of what I was talking to you about before with people moving in, and Detroit's a blank slate kind of a thing. And, well, it's not. You know, people live there. They have been living there.
Right.
And then the third thing you mentioned was, a metonym for the American condition. And I would say that our film probably falls closer to that description, but maybe not quite perfectly, which I don't know how I feel about that. Part of me as an artist and filmmaker wants to say, yeah, look what's happening in Detroit. You know, this is not that uncommon. You know, what Jackrabbit Luke and Darris are facing in their lives is something that many, many people in this country also have faced and will continue to face. So you can't really avoid that kind of a conversation about it. But it's not really designed as a film to explicitly say this is the canary in the coal mine kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's not. And that's what makes it an original film, I think. It really not. It's not one of those quote-unquote issue films. I mean, that would undermine the sense of the personal in it. And we'll get to these men. Let me play a moment, though. This is a moment in the film at a protest. It's not a protest. It's a public gathering, and different people are speaking. And this particular woman she raises a critical question that I want to play this moment and have you talk about this. This is from Andrew James' film, Street Fighting Men.
We have to love these kids and not be afraid of them. We have to look in the eyes of someone else and see ourselves.
Yes.
They feel like we've abandoned them.
Yes.
Listen to what they're saying.
We know we have to speak for our children.
Yes.
We must protect them.
Yes.
We must stop letting everybody take everything away from them and then expecting them to come out and be righteous people. What do they have, Lord? We keep allowing it to be taken away.
Seems like this is such the dilemma. they're trying to love their kids. And you see these kids on bikes riding around the neighborhoods, right? And you see them and Jack Rabbit responding to them. It's one of these beautiful moments in the film later on. He feels these are the kids, he says, that came. And when he was, I guess he had an ice cream truck for a while, and these are the kids in the neighborhood that came. And later they did this horrible crime. So it's the idea of protecting them, but also being afraid of them. I think that's such an interesting dilemma that they're working through.
That was one thing that really struck me, because I think there's this idea that, you know, white people are afraid of black people. Black people are criminals. This sort of these false ideas that have come across to us through media. And because of the history of racism in this country, the legacy of it. But when I got to Detroit, I realized that has also affected people of color as well. And that even they themselves sometimes are afraid of kids in their own community and how that makes them feel. And that really, like, it broke my heart to see that. There's, you know, a scene in the film where they talk about it, you know, where Myrtle, a woman from the community, is talking to Jackrabbit. Yeah. And she says, I don't want to be afraid of my kids anymore or people who look like me. And that, to me, is such a interesting and, like, fraught and complicated and, like, powerful statement. And it speaks to the challenges that they're facing in the community, where they are fighting this sort of outside perception of them while also trying to help the kids in their own community realize that, hey, you're not doing anyone any favors here by engaging in this activity. You know, there are better ways to get ahead. You don't have to resort to crime or drugs. And I think that you see a generational divide almost in the community between the younger kids and some of the older, longtime residents, because the young kids have grown up without a lot of the same opportunity. And there's developed, I think, an attitude that say, well, I'm not going to get ahead doing X, Y, Z, so I'm going to try this instead. And you see the community really grapple with that in the film. What are we doing for our kids?
Right.
What's our responsibility?
Right. Let's play that moment, actually. This is Myrtle Thompson and Jack Rabbit. We'll talk about how you found Jack Rabbit here in a moment. But I think this is an important moment to play.
We put them kids when they was 5 and 6 on our Christmas card that we sent all over the country. And we embraced them. We talked to them, and they was all in all kind of cadet programs with the police and all kind of stuff. But they just, that was one bunch we lost, you know. And it just hurt. One thing I could point out about these guys, none of them had regular jobs. Not one of them had a regular job.
What's a regular job?
McDonald's, anything like that. None of
but
them.
But I don't have a job, and I ain't got no money to feed myself. If somebody gonna give me a bag of marijuana to sell, and I can make me $30 a day and take home and get my baby some Pampers or something like this, what am I supposed to do if I can't go get a job because my ID ain't valid? I don't even know how to read and write to fill out an application because I couldn't make it through school because I didn't have the support. Ain't nobody at home trying to help me. What should I do? We had the drug dealers living next door. We had to confront them face to face and talk on a level of, I ain't trying to take nothing out your mouth, but I don't want your customers knocking on my door, so what you gonna do? Because I don't want to be scared of somebody who look like me. I just don't want to. It don't feel good. It don't feel good.
It's from Andrew James' film, Street Fighting Men. This coming Monday night at 7 o'clock, we're going to be screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. And I know it's the day of the eclipse. It's going to take some effort for some of you maybe to get back for the film, but we're really hoping you take that extra effort. It really is an extraordinary film. This is part of our Through the Lens series with the Utah Film Center. Again, screening it Monday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. I'm underlining Monday night because we usually do these things on Wednesday. We're doing this on Monday, so please try to join us at 7 o'clock. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our documentary series with Andrew James' film called Street Fighting Men. It's a documentary about America's devastated black working class in Detroit. Really, though, it's a profile of three men who are trying to build something for themselves in their community. So it seems like you're way in to at least the story part. At first, you're thinking, oh, maybe it's about Detroit, and then you started to meet these people. Let's talk about James Jackson, Jack Rabbit. If I understand this story right, you saw a photo of him?
I saw an article.
An article.
There was a piece in the Detroit Metro Times, which is the weekly newspaper in Detroit, called Street Fightin' Man, with the apostrophe.
Yeah.
And had a great photo on for the article, yeah, of Jack Rabbit and his partner Keith, kind of with their arms folded, looking tough,
yeah,
in front of their Welcome to Our Neighborhood sign. And it just struck me, just, I don't know, it just resonated with me, these guys taking matters into their own hands and the fact that there's not enough, you know, funding for the police in Detroit. So people call the police and they don't show up for 24 hours, 48 hours, especially if it's not a violent crime.
Yeah.
So you have Jackrabbit, who's an ex-cop in a neighborhood that is experiencing an influx of crime and drugs, and the police are not responding to these calls, at least not in a timely manner. And the neighborhood's getting frustrated, and eventually Jackrabbit starts to take matters into his own hands. And he starts to patrol the neighborhood. He's a retired cop, so he has a tow truck business now. And he's got this great big tow truck. It says Masters of Disaster on it. And he drives around the neighborhood with a camera. And he's like the jolly old man of the neighborhood. Everybody loves him. And he waves and everybody honks back. And he knows what's going on in the community. And he's got an eye for this stuff because of his work in the police department. He did some undercover work as well, I believe. So now he sort of fancies himself as this kind of, I don't want to say vigilante because he's not actually, you know.
He's not really a vigilante, but he's there to witness, right? He has this video camera. He films things. He watches things. It's almost like he's just observing on some level almost.
Right, right. And he hopes that those observations can then encourage the police to come and do their job. He said, look what I caught on camera. Look what I did. You know, in the film, you see them bust a couple guys breaking into Wendy's. And so you do see that their tactics have had success in the past. But I think the film ends up kind of asking the question, how successful are these tactics really in the long term? And is it sustainable for community members to take these responsibilities on themselves?
There's a moment I want to play, this moment from when Jack Rabbit appears on this radio program with this minister, Malik Shabazz. You want to say something about his radio program? It seems like another one of these attempts to plug into the community and change things.
Yeah, so Minister Shabazz is a really interesting person, a man that I got to know while I was there. And he has a local access TV show where they discuss Detroit issues and local interest stories. And I got to know him through a group called the Detroit 300, which you also get a glimpse of in the film. And they're activists, and they're part of the Black Panther movement. And they're very religious, and they're trying to close down crack houses, and they're trying to close down drug operations, and they're trying to bring the community together, and they're trying to make the police more accountable. And that's sort of his whole shtick. And they end up crossing paths with Jack Rabbit in the film.
All right, good evening. I'm Minister Malik Shabazz. Joining us in studio, we have Brother Jack Rabbit, known on the Deep East Side, and known some other places too. Brother been holding it down, trying to keep the community going, trying to keep the community safe. And you were formerly a police officer?
Yes, I'm retired.
How long?
Police officer. 20 years. Okay. Retired from gang squad.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so when you retired, why didn't you just run on off to La La Land, kick back and not be involved and go for yours? You know what everybody say today. I'm going for mine. Forget about you.
Well, I'm going for mine, Detroit.
Okay.
I stayed here.
All right.
You know, this is home.
Yes, sir.
And we got a lot of time and energy invested in the city. Blood, sweat, tears.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't see leaving all that behind.
I know that, sir.
I really love that exchange where he's like, I'm going for mine here. Like, why would I leave?
Right.
And isn't that kind of an underlying concept? Like, why would I leave? This is what I know. This is home. And as he says, he literally has a lot invested in that community.
And many other people do as well.
Yep.
And that's what I found. So, you know, you can't just leave behind a home you've lived in for 50 years. Maybe it belonged to your grandma. Maybe she passed it on to someone else in the family. That kind of thing happens a lot. And when you own a home, it's you can't just walk away from that. And home prices are also, you know, a big concern, I think, for certain homes in Detroit. And it's not always easy to sell your home. It's not easy to get out or to leave. Some people say, well, if you don't like Detroit, just leave.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, if you don't like America, just leave kind of a thing. And so Jack Rabbit's like, no, this is it. This is my home. This is, you know, I bought this place. My son lives next door, you know. This is it.
How did you find Darris?
So we found Darris through the Young Detroit Builders, which is an organization in Detroit. It's part of the Youth Build program. They have chapters nationwide, and they take kids who have, for whatever reason, dropped out of high school, and they bring kids into this environment where they get practical skills with construction and carpentry while also getting their GED. And it's a way to help kids kind of get back on track. And
it seems like, before you say anything more, it seems like building is a metaphor in this film.
Yeah.
The idea of building, literally building, and maybe even as a metaphor.
Yeah, that's very that's a really good observation. You know, you have Luke, who we haven't talked about yet, who's who's building a home.
Yep.
He's bought a dilapidated former crack house, and he's moved in there with his dog, and he's trying to get his piece of the American dream. He's trying to build up this house. You've got Darris, who's going back to school. He's in the Young Detroit Builders, and there's all kinds of shots of them building and learning and working and constructing. And then you have Jackrabbit, who is also trying to build in a way.
Yep.
And so I think part of my philosophy for the film was drawing on this Italian neorealist kind of philosophy, making a film about working people, making a film about people who are struggling in the aftermath of industry leaving their communities, and seeing how so much of what we take for granted has been taken away in places like the Jefferson Chalmers neighborhood in Detroit, where you can't rely on the police, where you can't rely on public education, where you can't rely on the fire department, you can't rely on your elected officials. So you're seeing a community take care of its own, take care of itself. And that is a form of building.
Yep.
So I think that the whole film is littered with these references to building and creating. And I would say all of them are trying to create a life for themselves, a better life for themselves here in America, in this time, in this crazy time that we're in right now, where it seems like so much is happening everywhere all the time. And I really wanted to just dial into the essence of these men and what they're trying to build and what they're fighting for. Sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's a collective thing. And for Jackrabbit, it's about the neighborhood and about his peace and quiet. And for Darris, it's about his daughter.
It's very much about Darris's daughter. Let's play another moment from the film. This is early on when we first, in those early moments when we come to meet Darris, this young man. And there's this great scene where he's getting his hair cut. And he's having this conversation with, I don't know the gentleman's name, he's the barber there. But he's more than that. I mean, he's going to help Darris. Would you just set this up for us, this moment?
Sure. So this is a scene where Darris is going and getting some advice from this guy named Jay.
Jay.
And he's sort of a figure in Detroit and as part of this network of NGOs and organizations that are trying to help youth in Detroit. And Darris gets plugged in with that and goes and gets a haircut and gets some advice.
I've always, you know what I'm saying, started something, but if I ain't like it, then I'll quit. Or find a shortcut like I've been doing pretty much my life.
Right, all right, so you've been doing that the majority of your life. And knowing that, and knowing your past, and knowing what you used to, What is going to make today any different from your yesterday and your day before that? You've been tired before.
My motivation is the child. You know what I'm saying? She keep me every time I think about her, I think about more ways that I got to grind or more ways that I have to do this, that, and the other. Basically, on the right side of the track. You know what I mean?
Got you.
So, all right. So me coming here to me, why would this be different from any other time? Is because my child is going to keep me, you know what I'm saying, around positive people like you, positive things that you do, you know, versus the other bullshit that I've been around, whether that be selling dope, whatever, hanging in the hood, not doing nothing, not getting educated, not pulling out college applications in nowhere, things like that.
Right. Okay. So. Now,
cool. Or basically, and on top of that, just getting plugged with people that could put me in a position to go where I want to go.
I got that part. But this is the thing. The working objective is to maximize all time and leverage each opportunity. Slide our passions down so when our passions meet opportunity, we can go and grow. You know what I'm saying?
I really love that exchange. And what's great about Darius is he's a devoted father. We see him caring for this baby, this little girl, in really lovely ways. And you see, you know, being a father is a parent in general, and in any of those circumstances that he's dealing with is not easy, but he's really motivated by that.
Yeah, he is. And that's one thing that I found really attractive about him as a subject, you know, because we followed a fair amount of subjects at the beginning and kind of weeded a few folks out and dialed in on Darius, Luke, and Jackrabbit, the three generations of men. So you've got the past, present, and future of the city, of the community. And how do their challenges and stories overlap naturally simply because of their proximity to one another in Detroit and being of different generations, what are the different opportunities and different systemic roadblocks that each of them are facing? And for Darius, it's education, it's opportunity. But in his child, he sees, I think, the potential, the possibility of a future. And I think that that's really motivating. And he was so eloquent in the way he would talk about her. And you could tell he truly loved her. Seeing him hold her. I mean, that was one of the first things I shot with him. Was we go in his bedroom, putting his daughter to sleep, and hear the police sirens outside, and seeing how tender he was with her. And I think that's a really powerful image.
Extremely. And I have to say, I was going to ask you about this, because it conveys a sense of intimacy. When he's laying there with the baby, trying to get the baby to go to sleep, they're just laying there. And you kind of forget, oh, there's a camera shooting this. There are other moments. Really, really intimate moments, a moment with Luke and his dog, which I don't want to give too much away about that, but that is extraordinary and incredibly intimate. And so the question always comes, and so maybe it's a dopey, obvious question, but how do you establish that kind of trust where you can be there for those moments of intimacy? How did that work for you as a filmmaker?
Honestly, it's just time.
Yeah.
It's you know, there's no real magic solution to like winning over people's trust. I didn't even think of it that way, because it's not like you're going in there with some sort of alternative agenda and I've got to win them over.
Yeah.
You're just going there and you're relating with them as fellow human beings and you're getting to know them as people. And I became really close with all three of the subjects. You know, I did not sort of create a distance between myself as a journalist. I let all my guard down, all my boundaries down, and I helped them out when I could. And I formed really deep relationships with them. So anytime the camera wasn't rolling, we were talking, we were chatting, we were getting to know each other. And I was really upfront with them about what I wanted to do with the movie. And I let them engage with me on that level and say, what do you want to accomplish with the film? I tried to bring them into the process as much as possible where they felt empowered to be with me on camera, feeling like they were in charge of the narrative that they were creating for themselves. And I tried to carry that through into the editing room as well, where it's not about pointing out flaws in their character. It's not about saying anything more than what they want to say. You know, I kept, I think, my journalistic integrity, but I also felt that I needed to get to know them. I needed to listen to them. That kind of deep listening that is required to make a film like this.
Yeah.
And it just requires time. And I
but just, you have to care for them. They have to know that, right?
Oh, totally. And I think I showed them that I did, and I felt from them that they also cared for me. So it was a very reciprocal thing. And it was one of the most positive experiences I've ever had in my life, honestly, getting to know these guys and getting to spend time with them. You know, I moved to Detroit to make the film.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm from Salt Lake. Not from, but I live here now. I've lived here for a long time. And my wife and I both moved to Detroit for a year. And I was filming 10 hours a day every day.
Wow.
Because, you know, I'd go home at night and dump the footage and get up the next day and do it again. And I think they saw my commitment as well. And they're, this guy is really committed to this. And that piqued their curiosity and want to know more about why I'm doing this and what am I trying to do and why is this white guy from Utah here in our community? That alone would be a conversation starter. And it's an in. You say, well, I'm a crazy person, I guess. You know, I'm here with a camera. I'm interested in hearing from you. I want to know what makes you tick. I want to know what makes this community tick. I think there's a really powerful story here that people need to see. And they would be like, wow, okay, cool. And we would engage in dialogue about politics, about current events. And we found that we had so much in common, and it made it really easy to trust each other and to work together.
You know, it seems like there's a lot of risk in this kind of style. If you say you're going to go with just a verite, fly-on-the-wall kind of style, you have to hope something dramatic happens. And not that it needs to be dramatic, because there were moments that were so simple that seemed really dramatic to me in watching this film. But you have to commit to this kind of style. And it seems like there's a lot of risk there. And I wonder, did you ever worry about it? Like, oh, man, I can't imagine you worried too much, because there's so much drama in these stories anyway. But, you know, there's a lot of risk involved.
Yeah, there is. And I don't know if I was fully aware of that when I first started, to be honest.
Right. Yeah.
I thought, wow, I've got this vision. I've got these great subjects, these great men who are willing to be on camera. And, you know, and I just thought, you know, I was really excited about the cinematic possibilities of it as a filmmaker. And, you know, I'm a political person. I don't consider myself an activist, but it also scratched that itch where I felt like I could go do something that I felt might be a positive impact on somebody in the world. So I don't know if I even thought fully through all the risks. I just thought, how fun and how exciting would it be, and how educational and enlightening would it be to go embark on a journey like this? And then as I was shooting, I quickly discovered all the pitfalls of shooting in this style and committing yourself to something like this. And a lot of times I was sitting around waiting for things to happen. You know, I would schedule a time and be like, I'm going to come hang out with you today. And I would just shoot whatever was happening. You know, I very rarely directed them or had them say something again. I felt like I really just wanted to observe. So in order to do that, in order to capture the dramatic moments, you just have to be around.
Yeah.
So my amazing partner and wife, Jolynn, supported us during that time. She worked, was able to keep her job, moved to Detroit. And I just spent all day with these guys, getting to know them and spending time. And it was so much fun, too, that I don't know, that the risks of it kind of seemed distant. And now that the film is finished, you know, it's a challenge to get people to see the film. Every part of the process is a challenge. So,
Sander James, his film is called Street Fighting Men, and you really need to come and see this film. This is Monday night at 7 o'clock. We usually do these things on Wednesdays. We're doing it on Monday. And I'm not sure how we did this, but we scheduled it on the day of the eclipse, which means it's going to take a little bit of effort for some of you to get to it. But this is a special film. You really need to see it. It's at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, downtown Salt Lake City, next Monday night. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. You can get details about all of this on our website, radiowest.org. We're going to take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with filmmaker Andrew James. We're talking about his film, Street Fighting Men. Let's talk about Luke. Luke Williams. How did you find him? I think I know this story, and it's great.
So Luke found us.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Luke found us. I was actually in the middle of the street shooting some ruin porn, which we didn't use in the final cut.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say that. Shooting B-roll.
I know what you mean.
It was, there's lots to look at in Detroit, and I was out just looking and getting shots and getting acquainted with the area. And Luke approached us and said, "Hey, what are you doing? What are you guys doing here in the middle of the street with this camera?" And I was there with my producer, Katie. I've got two producers, Katie and Sarah. And we said, "Oh, we're making a film about, back then, about the neighborhood, about Detroit and blah, blah, blah." And he said, "Oh, fantastic. You should come check out my house project." And we said, "Okay, sure, let's go, And we got to know him, spoke to him. He's a very charming, really interesting person, so we scheduled a time and went to his house and saw what he was doing and just kind of naturally kept – he would call us and say, "Hey, you guys want to come over?" "Sure," He kind of encouraged us in a way. And eventually – the first time I got there and saw his house and met Irie, his dog, and saw what he was doing, I was pretty blown away by his commitment to this project and to how hard it was being sort of a one-man show, rehabbing this home on his own, scraping together used materials, working a part-time job, not getting paid very much, saving all this money to put this dream together. And I just thought, this is kind of what America is all about.
Totally, right?
Yeah.
And it's so dusty and grimy. There are moments, and it's Detroit. So in winter, it is, you can tell it's brutally cold.
Yeah, totally. Freezing. I don't know what probably the insulation was probably gone, and the electricity had issues, was on and off, no running water. And he was living there with his dog, with a great attitude, with a positive energy, trying to fix up this home. And you just can't turn away from something like that.
There's such momentum here too, and I'm not going to give away anything in this film, but there's a moment, let's call it a setback, right, and leave it at that.
Sure.
But it's pretty heart-wrenching, I have to say. And there's a moment when he's talking with his mom, Adina, and she's trying to buck him up. And there's this reference to running a race in here. Let me play this moment. I want to have you talk about this.
"You got to reach out to the mayor, Bing. Hello? He said he's doing Detroit, right? Write him a nice letter. You can't go in and talk to him. I'm at such and such a place. I have nothing. What can the city of Detroit do to help me? I am such and such a person."
"Oh, get him a list of shelters where you can go."
"Luke,
make sure you get a list now."
"That's what Bing would do. But what I'm trying to say, you never know, Luke."
"But at my age, at my time, I think this race for me is has been ran already. And I came to Detroit. I took a detour and I came to Detroit.
Okay,
and I did Detroit. And I think it's time for me to go."
"Let me ask you something.
Let me ask you something.
The race has been run."
"Yes."
"But you haven't won yet. Oh. You're still running.
Oh, I'm
you haven't gotten to the finishing line yet."
"Oh.
Hello, you remember the dash?"
"Yeah.
And everything that happened in between the dash?"
"Yeah."
"Okay. Well, this is the dash. You got to keep on running. You can't stop."
At this moment, he's so down. And it's funny. And it's like, if this is about a person's relationship with Detroit, there's at least a moment where he's like, I'm finished with this place.
Right. And that's pretty common, too. There's so much sadness in Detroit, just to be honest about it. so much joy as well, too. I mean, the people I met in Detroit are some of the best people I've ever met in my life. It's an amazing place. But there are a lot of hardships there, and people tend to get discouraged. Luke faces a major setback with his house project, is very discouraged by it, and his mom is just there to give him some real talk. And they have a very interesting dynamic that way. And they have this sort of banter that they engage in, and she's in some other scenes as well. And she's, you know, she's encouraging him not to give up, not to lose his optimism, to lose the spirit that, you know, the spirit that we were attracted to initially when we met him. She's kind of pushing him onward. And, you know, here's the card from the person at the church with the money in it. And, you know, you see how you can't do it alone.
Yeah.
You know, you can't take on a house project alone. Like, I mean, maybe sometimes you have to. You make these kind of choices and engage in a quest like that. But I think that's one thing the film shows is that you can't be like a cowboy. You can't be like the lone ranger out there. Like, we really need each other.
This is kind of where faith comes in, right? Mm-hmm. And it's another one of those seems like running themes in the film. There's work. There's manhood. There's faith. That's another one. Say something about that, because that, I don't know if you expected that, but that certainly is an issue in the film.
It is. And it's something I don't want to shy away from either. You know, all three of the men, Darris, Luke, and Jackrabbit, are all men of faith. And faith plays a major role in their lives and in the lives of many people in their community. I saw it everywhere that I went. A lot of the activism is tied in to local churches. It's really the backbone, almost the foundation of a lot of the activism and a lot of the community organizing, and the strength of the community sort of rests on that in a way. So I didn't want to shy away from it. You know, I've been through my own spiritual journey, but it's something that found its way into the film, and I'm really happy about it, because faith can be expressed in a lot of ways, not just religiously, and you see it expressed maybe religiously through the characters in the film, but it takes faith to get up every day and go work on that house. It takes faith every day to get out there and fight crime without the police around, or to try to be there for your community. That takes faith to get up every day and go to the Young Detroit Builders, you know, to drop your kid off and to get on the bus and, like, head to school every day with no promise of reward at the end. You know, that takes faith. I think all three of the men are such great examples of hard work and faith and sacrifice that I look up to personally. And as I was editing the film and observing them, I had to confront my own weaknesses and confront myself in a way as I was making the film, looking at these men and admiring them so much and seeing how much faith and hard work and commitment it took for them to just engage with the world around them on a day-to-day basis, that it forced me to really, like, change my attitude about things in life, and to be more grateful and less cynical and things like that.
One of the most beautiful moments for me in the film was when Jackrabbit is sitting in church listening to a sermon. It's Bishop Van Edgar at the Second Ebenezer Church.
Edgar Van, sorry. Yeah.
I actually was thinking of playing this, but I don't want to, because I don't want to really give this moment away either. But it's just the moment is so powerful. With Jack sitting there, and he becomes overcome. It's kind of a culmination moment in some ways. It ties everything together. Not in a tidy way, but it's just such a moment of hope. I really loved that part.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I felt that that moment really encapsulated kind of what the movie is about. It's about not giving up. It's about working hard and not giving up. And having faith, you know, because that's kind of what it takes sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's what it took for these three men when I was there in Detroit. And what Bishop Van says, you know, in his sermon was so relatable to so many people. You see Jackrabbit, you know, raise his fist, and he's tearing up, and you see the entire room stand and raise their fists. There's just like a longing in the community for acceptance and for success and for happiness and for the oppression to end. Because that's really what Jackrabbit and his community is facing, is a form of oppression, you know, and Daris and Luke as well. You know, they're all facing the sort of systemic oppression that many people of color face in this country today, especially working people of color, poor people, poor white people as well. You see that there's a longing to sort of rise out of these circumstances. And in that sermon, in that moment, it kind of ties in the journey of all the characters.
It's Andrew James. He's director, cinematographer, editor of Street Fighting Men. And we're really hoping you come and see this film. It's Monday night. Not Wednesday night, like we often do. This is Monday night. Yes, it's the day of the eclipse. The eclipse will be over. If you get back, please come at 7 o'clock to the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is our partnership with Utah Film Center, our Through the Lens series. You can get information about all of it on our website, radiowest.org. Andrew James, congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Zoe Wolf McGinn. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.